From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strangchamps, and we're coming to you live this week from St. Louis, Missouri, the Gateway. The city with a lot of pride. Gateway City. Home of the Gateway Arch, the tallest monument in the United States, a 630-foot-high stainless steel metaphor. Well, think about it. An arch, a gate, is an opening, a threshold, an entrance. But a gate is also an exit, and a gate can be a barrier. It's one of the oldest and most powerful symbols in the world for transformation. So what is it like to live in a city with a giant arch, a gate, at its heart? Writer Edward McPherson.
St. Louis is a city of gates that do not normally swing wide. 5 years ago, when my wife and I moved to town, we were taken aback. Everywhere, gates, gates, gates. Gates that lock and unlock according to schedules known only to residents. Gates with signs. Private street. No through traffic. Private neighborhood. No trespassing. Gates. St. Louis is often ranked as one of the country's most segregated cities. How curious that this city's most famous symbol is an open, soaring gate. The Gateway Arch was designed in 1947 by Finnish futurist Eero Saarinen. A 630-foot tall and wide stainless steel curve made of tapering equilateral triangles. A mathematical dream rising over the heartland. 40 downtown blocks were leveled to make room for the arch, many of them home to poor bohemians, artists, and African Americans. At the dedication, Vice President Hubert Humphrey proclaimed the Gateway Arch would provide a new sense of urgency to wipe out every slum. A day or two after reading Humphrey's speech, I hear a historian say on the radio that the arch is destined to be remembered by history as a monument to the mid-20th century, to an America so powerful, so brash, so sure of its future that it would destroy a downtown to put up a symbol. There's the old joke, what kind of city would advertise itself as a jumping-off point, an exit door, a gateway to somewhere else? Here's the thing, the arch is beautiful. It changes color with the weather and hour. Sometimes sky blue, sometimes gunmetal gray, sometimes pitch black. Its shape is the natural curve a cable makes when suspended between two points, called a flattened catenary arch. The name comes from the Latin word for chain. One hot summer day, I ride a tiny tram capsule up the north leg of the arch. The 1960s space age pod barely fits 5 people. A futuristic female voice tells me, the Gateway Arch transcends time. The trip lasts 4 minutes. Arches, it should be noted, hold themselves up. They rise on their own weight. They compress. Higher pieces push down and out on those below. But it was never a pure construct. It sways some 18 inches, like a chain or a gate, upheld for now by forces great and unseen.
That's writer Edward McPherson, and that's a short excerpt from his brand new book, The History of the Future. And actually, he's here in the house tonight. Edward, where are you? Stand up and take a bow. Thank you for coming out tonight, and big thanks to St. Louis Public Radio for hosting us and for carrying this show for more than a decade. Over the years, we've probably heard from about half of you here. Thanks for correcting my grammar. So as you know, every week, to the best of our knowledge, is built around a theme. And when we were planning this show and trying to figure out what we'd be talking about tonight, everyone said, please, just not the Gateway Arch. You know, can we have a theme that is not on the keychains and the mugs at the airport? But the arch turned out to be a stubborn metaphor. We'd be in a staff meeting, pitching ideas, and no matter what the story was, someone would always wind up saying, you know, that's kind of a gateway moment. So finally, we just gave up. So what do we mean by gateway moments? Well, I mean the big transformational moments of your life, the really significant moments that take your life in a whole new direction. We've all had them. I'm 56. I've given birth twice. I've been married twice. And what I know about those gateway moments is that they are almost by definition uncomfortable. In the case of childbirth, excruciating. But breaking through to new places takes work. That's true personally and also collectively. And you here in St. Louis, you know a lot about that. So we thought maybe you'd have some things to teach us. For example, 100 years ago, the worst race riot in American history happened here, and it helped spark the civil rights movement. Black Lives Matter became a national movement here. So talking about racism, about structured, systematic inequality, it's really hard. But those conversations can be gateway moments. They can lead to real change. So let me welcome two people who are making some of those conversations happen nationally and on the ground. Welcome, please, Camille Stanley and Tim Lloyd, the producers and co-hosts of St. Louis Public Radio's podcast about race and class, We Live Here, and our own producer, Charles Monroe Payne.
So I want to play a clip of you guys talking about your podcast and talking about how you write your scripts. For those of us in radio, you know, scripts are sacred because that's the words you say that are in your mouth. And I want to play a clip of you guys talking about how you write your scripts.
So the way that we write this show, we write it together.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that means you writing words to put into my mouth and me writing words to put into your mouth.
And I can clearly remember a few times where one of us will veto a line.
Right.
Because we don't like the wording, but more often it's something more weighty, more serious, where I will say, you know, as a black woman, that line does not work. This line is, you know, presenting this issue or whatever from a white savior perspective, and we will not be using it in this show.
Yeah.
You know, I when I listen to your I like your podcast, and it's not just for the content, but it's the relationship that the two of you have. And it's a relationship that I think a lot of white people are afraid of. A lot of white people want to do the right thing, but they're afraid they're going to make a mistake. They're afraid that the relationship they have with this black person, that black person becomes their explainer, and that person doesn't want to do that either. So everyone just stops. The white people stop and don't move it forward. As you're a journalist,
mm-hmm.
How do you handle not being the explainer, not handling that with him and with the listeners?
Sometimes I just refuse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like it's not my job to make your white guilt go away. I don't have white guilt, so I can't help you with it. it's honestly something you probably need to talk to your white friends about.
Right.
And so I will just push back when people try to like put me in that role.
But it is your problem, and not only is it, it's as a white guy, but also this is your job, mm-hmm. and you get schooled, right? She's like, no, I ain't right. You're not going to write that for me. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, you know, this is coming from your white privilege. I don't know, if somebody said that to me, I'd feel bad if somebody said that to me. And not feeling bad isn't the worst thing in the world. But, like, how do you handle that? How do you handle a meeting over a script where someone says, nope, dude, that's bright privilege. Am I cut out for the red pen?
I think maybe the fear that you're describing is because a lot of white people don't have genuine relationships with anyone who's not white. I think the reason why Camille can check me and I can be like, good point, is because we like each other. We know each other, you know? And that's how maybe you really get over the fear, is step outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, recognize your privilege and do all of those things, but step outside yourself and say, you know, if I make it about my guilt, that's making it about me, and that's not fair, you know? I mean, if we're writing a script together and it's a shared script, then I have to be open to being checked. And because we have a real relationship and how we write, that's okay.
And it goes both ways.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, you know, like when I said, like in the clip, like we give each other veto power, like we really do give each mm-hmm. other veto power. Mm-hmm. So there's stuff that like I'll write and he'll be like, nah.
Yeah. Now you guys have a tagline.
We do.
That I really like. And your tagline is that your show is for people on the woke spectrum.
That's a new
tagline.
Yeah,
that's a new tagline.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I giving away the new thing?
You want to hear the old one? It's really catchy. You want to hear the old one?
What's the old one?
Are you ready for the most public radio tagline of all time?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. Race, class, power, poverty, systems, and the people they touch.
Boring.
I mean,
rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. Tell us how you feel about that. I think you're bossing here. So, a radio show for people on the woke spectrum. But the thing about this, having a show for people on the woke spectrum, I get that. I, of course, immediately want to put myself on the woke spectrum, on the enlightened continuum, wherever that space is. I don't know where it goes, but, you know, I want to be on there at least. But then I think, well, what about my racist uncle? Or I start thinking about other people that are not on the woke spectrum,
mm-hmm.
who need to be awoke. They're, mm-hmm. they're not. That's just, your show's not for them?
No.
All right. No, it's good. It's good. I will not give him the podcast. I will not give him the podcast. I have a question for both of you, and I would like to start with you and ask you both the same question, and that is, you've been working on a show on race and class.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of issues on race in this city, issues from Ferguson to segregation to everything in between. How has it affected? How have you changed as a human being by working on the show?
Yeah, so I tend to think in sort of concrete terms, concrete examples. I was writing something a few weeks ago, and I think the line was after Michael Brown's death, young black activists took to the streets and demanded equity from systems built on racist ideas. Now, I can say that very calmly now, and very clearly now. I could not do that 2 years ago. You know, 2 years ago, I would have put like this, that idea might have been in there, but I would have like layered this beautiful, like public radio fondant on top of it. Like,
I know, dude, the fondant.
You know, yes. What we do.
I have consumed
it. And so
I wouldn't
have been that direct with it. And I think, you know, personally, and I was thinking about this the other day, so my wife and I have a 3.5-year-old son. And so working on this show and learning how to be direct with these issues and communicate that directness, I'm also learning how to be a dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I often will catch myself thinking, what kind of dad would I have been if I wasn't thinking as directly as I am now about these issues? And those are real gut check moments for me.
Mm. What about you? What is working on the show? How has it affected you personally?
When I took this job, I knew that it was going to be a challenge professionally and personally. Like, professionally, because I am a former newspaper reporter, I was switching mediums, and that was going to be different. I was moving to a brand new city that I had no connection to. That's going to be different. But I also knew that it was going to take something out of me personally, because I, in my previous job, although I covered issues of race and did investigations about stuff like that, that wasn't like, I wasn't immersed in it. And so coming here And also being a black woman, I knew that it was going to be taxing, and that was it was going to take something out of me, and it has.
Yeah,
it's been, in a lot of ways, it's been very fulfilling, but in a lot of ways, it's been very draining.
One last question. Say we wake up in a month from now, and it's, you know, I don't know, the race problem has been solved. I know that's not probably going to ever happen, but so there's no more racism. The race problem has been solved. Classism is gone, and you still love radio, and you both want to work together. What would you podcast if you didn't have to deal with the problems?
Oh, we have so many ideas.
What would, what would be your first podcast if you didn't have to deal with society's problems?
Food.
Yeah, that was hilarious. We have talked extensively at the about the barbecue show that we are going to do together. Yeah.
So if you solve the race problem, then you can do the barbecue show.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we could do the barbecue show now. Yeah.
Well, thank you very, very much. And, you know, we've got to say goodbye. There's Tim Lloyd and Camille Stanley. They host and produce We Live Here.
You guys are so lucky to have such amazing storytellers here. And you have another one. One of the greatest living American storytellers also lives right here in St. Louis. His name is Bobby Norfolk. He is a living historian, which means that he brings forgotten history to life in person. And he's here tonight to give us an excerpt from his one-man play, Shadow Ball.
Good evening. Good evening is good. Back in the day, the Indianapolis Clowns from the Negro National League used to have a pantomime called Shadow Ball, where they would pretend to be throwing balls from the mound, whoosh, connecting with the ball, catching pop flies, boom, and running bases, boogity, 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 boogity. Now, they call that game shadow ball. It's a metaphor how African Americans played ball in the shadow of segregated America. But two of the superstars back in the day both played in St. Louis, James Cool Papa Bell and Leroy Satchel Paige. Papa Bell got his notoriety as a fast runner, but he started with the East St. Louis Cubs and the Compton Hill Cubs as a pitcher. Cool Papa Bell had this knuckleball that would tie batters up in knots, but Cool Papa Bell got his notoriety as a runner. He was in his prime, the fastest man on the planet. Cool Papa Bell could run the bases in 12 seconds flat. 13.1 if the bases were wet with rain. But Cool Papa Bell said that one time he was playing with the Monarchs and the St. Louis Stars, and he kept seeing this guy Oscar Charleston come up to bat. And when Cool Papa Bell was on the mound one day, here comes Oscar Charleston coming up to bat. Now, Oscar Charleston was mean. Cool Papa Bell snatched the hood off of a Klansman head one day down in Selma, Alabama. And this is who Cool Papa Bell is facing on the mound. Oscar Charleston comes up to bat. My boy was built like Babe Ruth, run like Ty Cobb. I told you Cool Papa had that knuckleball. He threw that knuckleball at Oscar. Miss. Threw another one. Miss. Threw a third one. He didn't swing. Umpire said, "Strike!" Struck him out. Ooh, Oscar got mad. He broke the bat over the leg. When the inning was over, Papa was walking back to the dugout. His friend said, "Man, that was real cool what you did, striking out Oscar Charleston like that." And then Coach Bill Gatewood said, "Man, you one cool Papa." And that's how the name got started. But one day, Cool Papa Bell and Satchel Paige was rooming together in California. Well, Satchel was a party animal, okay? And Cool Papa was a church man. He called his wife Clara, and they was talking back and forth, and Cool Papa was reading the Bible and was ready for bed and hit the switch, but 3-second delay before the lights went out. Cool Papa had an idea. Ding! He waited until Satchel Paige got back to the room, put on his pajamas. He said, lights out, Satch.
Yeah, Cool Papa.
Satch, watch this. Cool Papa Bear hit that switch, jumped in the bed before the lights went out. Satch said, whoa, man, you are fast. I'm telling everybody in the world about this. My boy, Cool Papa Bear, he's so fast, he can turn off the light and be in the bed
before the lights would go out.
Cool Papa Bell, after 24 years of playing, did not make it to the majors. Satchel Paige made it to the majors with the Cleveland Indians at age 42, still striking out players half his age. But Cool Papa Bell said, people always tell me I was born too early.
That's not true. They opened the doors too late.
But I was a good player. I played the game that I love. I have no regrets. He said, baseball is like the game of life. You can't just run through life with a chicken like his head cut off. You have to take your time, think it over, live life slow. You have to watch the pitcher, find the right pitch, and then run before the catcher can throw you out. Do your best to score. Treat everybody with respect. What are you going to do with your life? He always told young people. Have purpose in your life. Find out what you want to do with it, because life is short, and before you know it, it's gone.
Before the lights go out.
Well, that was the great storyteller, playwright, and living historian Bobby Norfolk. And now, one woman who can make herself sound like 10. The incredibly talented Sinuso Pro. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. And we're back at the Sheldon Concert Hall in St. Louis, Missouri. And this hour, we're talking about gateway moments. And sometimes you don't find your gateway. it finds you. Our next story is about three brothers, Sam, Seth, and Adam Koster. They develop video games for a living. Now, three siblings working together might kind of sound like a recipe for disaster, but these three really make it work. They kind of had to, because the stakes for their last game were life or death.
We all took really divergent paths to get into video games.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Adam's a PhD in microbiology. I went to law school, and I'm a chartered financial analyst, and Sam went to school for psychology. And this just kind of happened organically.
The first game that we made that actually managed to get us both some eyeballs and some revenue was called Talphite 2, The Monocle of Destiny. So you run around, and the whole theme of the game is that you're this elderly man who is wormholed into an alternate dimension, and you have a monocle, and it can fire animals out of it. Our marketing line was shoot animals out of your face. The praise was great, the reviews were very, very good, but the game was a total financial failure. Probably the biggest hit to our overall
consideration. Productivity?
Yeah, productivity, our consideration of whether or not butterscotch was actually going to be a thing was when I started just getting really tired. And then I started waking up with these full-blown night sweats. It was like someone just dumped a whole bucket of water on me while I was sleeping. Finally, I made an appointment at an infectious disease clinic. I had Googled a bunch, gone on WebMD, decided I had Lyme disease. So I went in and I said, hey, you know, pretty sure it's just Lyme disease. And I took off my shirt, and the PA, the physician's assistant who was seeing me, I mean, her eyes got big, and she was like, I'm going to go get the doctor real quick. And he comes running in and cops a feel on my lat, and he steps back and he goes, how old are you? And I said, 23. And he goes, well, pretty sure that's cancer.
Sam called me from his car on a video call using Google Hangouts and told me, and I was like, okay, well, whatever we got to do, we'll do it.
Crashlands is an action crafting RPG that is set in a world of outlandish technology and magic. The goal with Crashlands was always to create an experience that people could fall into such a degree that the world went away. And then the game itself was what I would have wanted at that moment that the diagnosis hit, and then the following, you know, months. This big, beautiful adventure where the world's crazy and everything's exciting and weird and just good.
Welcome with me, please, Sam Koster. So Crashlands turned out to be a really big hit.
Yeah, it went a little gangbusters. We thought it was going to go well, but we got editor's choice on iTunes and sold over 370,000 copies in the last year.
Congratulations. So. And you're in remission, too, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's the best part. Yeah.
So, and that must feel pretty great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Was designing the game therapeutic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I did all the art for the game, and a lot of it actually was done in either a hospital bed or a chemo chair with that little tiny mouse. And being able to escape into the work in a lot of ways. And then while the design side is still just work in an interesting sense, it's thinking, but it's a lot of thinking about how a player's going to react and what a player's going to feel. I do think it is really therapeutic to actually be working toward creating a lot of joy for someone else while you're going through that sort of infinite duress period.
Mm-hmm. And was playing the game itself, because you were wearing two hats. You were both designing the game and thinking about, and that was work.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were times when you'd just be playing the game for fun. Which was more therapeutic?
I think the biggest ones were actually when I would be in the hospital, and my favorite example is Seth called and he was like, you know, how you doing? You want me to come by tonight? Because I was trapped in the hospital getting this high-dose chemotherapy drug. And I said, no, but I would like you to finish programming the gardening mechanic if you could. Because I really want to build a garden in here. And just a few hours later, there's a, you know, there's a new build, and I get to pull it down and go and do this thing, right? And, you know, as a game developer, it's actually not that often that you get to be surprised by the stuff that you designed because you made it. You can't tickle yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so I actually, like, I've never been able to have that first time experience playing this thing. But I've gotten to see other people do it, and I've gotten little glimpses of it like that. Yeah.
Have you talked with other people, other cancer patients who've played the game, and have they found it to be a refuge, therapeutic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had this guy named James from the UK. He was one of our beta testers, actually. He was going through chemotherapy, and he sent me a note, and he said, you know, I was thrown up from chemotherapy today, but all I could think about was getting back to Crashlands. Got to harvest more of those trees. So I think, yeah, there's you know, we had people who have PTSD who have written into us. Basically, anybody who's had a period of their life, which is everybody, where things aren't going right. We often talk in the studio about how the real purpose of games is to manufacture achievement for people. Mm.
So it seems to me that video games as a medium are really coming of age, and we've watched it happen. So do you feel like how we think about games is changing? Are we learning to take them more seriously?
I think we're starting to figure out kind of what they are. And I think that's
what
been
are
the difficult. I don't know. It's I think Jesse Schell, who runs a studio called Shell Games, defines them as a machine that interacts with the mind to manufacture joy.
Oh, I love that.
And I think, of course, you can play video games too much. You know, most people's hobbies are something that you can do too much. And I think video games are a media category that, of course, you can overdo, just like Netflix or, you know, public radio. I don't know if that's possible.
No, not
possible.
Sorry.
Not at all.
It's
Sorry.
Not that
I
much
think,
fun.
Yeah, I think but yeah, so I do think we're starting to understand what they are. And I do think there've been plenty of people trying to push the art form, but the reality is that game dev is a weird thing in that it's nearly every single discipline sort of shoved together in its one package. Crashlands has a 50,000 word written narrative in it. It has cinematography when we decide we need to move the camera around, do stuff with it. Tons of user experience design and all sorts of weird psychology going on, where we're essentially combining, you know, music, written art, and graphical art in this really incredible way with programming to create an experience that ideally is very compelling and something that lets people escape enough.
So are you saying that developing a game or creating a game is almost a way of thinking, a way of approaching the world?
Correct. And you get to give that to people. And I think that's one of the really powerful ways of doing it. And you know, you can force people to do things that they wouldn't want to do. Like, there's a game called The Walking Dead. And one of the things that happens, someone gets their leg caught in a bear trap. You have to choose, okay, are we going to leave this person while the zombies are coming? Or I have an axe in my hand, so am I going to chop off this leg? But what they do, and this is the critical point about games, is that they don't just let you say, chop off the leg. You have to click. Every click is a swing.
Oh!
Right? You feel it. You're like, I kind of feel like I know what it's like to hack a man's leg off with an axe now. You know? I'm going to try to avoid those situations. So I think you can take these experiences to this next level by making people participate viscerally.
So what are you working on next? What's next for Sam Koster?
Our big thing over the last year with the success of Crashlands is actually growing the studio. So that's sort of been our big focus. We just hired 4 people, so it's no longer just the 3 of us brothers working in an apartment. It's now 7 people working in a basement. So we're, you know, one level up. But we actually have 2 games in the works right now. I can't say much about them. One's a big one and one's a small one, so hopefully you'll see one out by us in 4 to 6 months, and then another one in a year and a half or 2.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us. Sam Koster, everybody.
Thanks.
Okay.
NSO Pro. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strangechamps, and we're coming to you live this week from St. Louis, Missouri. Father-daughter beatboxing team Nicole Paris and Ed Cage.
Jamaica, stop.
You guys want to sit down?
Yeah, let's stand.
Let's stand up.
Yeah,
yeah, keeping up with these young people, I almost had to ask my wife for that Buterol because I was like, we don't have to do another session.
You have 160 million views on your YouTube of you guys doing this. 160 million.
Thank you.
Can you put that in perspective for people? What's that done to your life?
Well, I will say I had to quit my job.
Great job.
I had to quit. I had people following me home, taking pictures, coming down from the room. I was a chef before the video went viral.
From your original video, I remember watching it. I remember when it came out and being like, everybody went crazy. So on Facebook, everybody went mad. Everybody wanted to share it. It's a competition.
Well, I mean, it's not really a competition. It's kind of more like collaborating, you know, especially with my pops. We've been doing this for a long time. We beatbox all day, every day.
We even beatbox in church. We'll throw beats at each other.
Oh, yes.
Really?
It doesn't make sense.
Seriously.
Let me give an example. I'm here. I'm going. Give me an example.
So we're sitting down, right?
Uh-huh.
And we're sitting, like, right next to each other. And I'll lean over and go, yes, and thank you, Jesus. Let us all go into prayer. And then I'll just be like, prayer, 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 prayer. I'm leaning in prayer. And he say, in Jesus' name. And then I'll be like, amen.
Of course, my
so
wife,
serious.
My wife, our mommy chair, as we call her, she's somewhere. She's sitting over to the side like the blood of Jesus.
No, yeah. Blood of Jesus.
Y'all cannot
do this. Then she'll text, y'all need to stop. Stop it in the name of Jesus.
Now, you can't use Jesus
one
like
thing
that.
One thing we were talking about backstage for you is that when you were a baby and you couldn't go to sleep. What did you do? How did you put her to sleep?
Well, at the time, I was a young parent. I was, what, 18, 19 when I had four jobs. I was uneducated, so I had to work a lot. So we had three other kids, so I had to figure out a way to bond with all three of my kids. One of my daughters liked politics, and my other son liked to keep me up with Pokemon and what was the purple dinosaur thingy?
Hey, I don't know.
I was going to say Bernie Madoff. That's not right.
He's from Kansas City. Barney from Kansas City.
Hit the jersey. I think you have song before.
But and hers was beatboxing. So I would come home and I would sit on the couch. I would be tired and she'll put her head up and she'll come over and I'll hold her and just real nice, simple beats to, you know, kind of calm her down. And then she would go spit all in my face.
Look at me now.
Yeah, yeah. So before you go, I would, if you don't mind, could you do kind of take us out with
yes!
One more thing? Yes.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Thank you, everyone. I appreciate you.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it. Thank you for having us.
So we started this hour talking about the St. Louis Arch as a metaphor, about gateway moments, personal and collective. And it would come full circle, back to bricks and mortar and stone and steel. Bob Hansman is a professor of architecture and of social justice. And really, what he teaches is border crossings. Yesterday, he took our staff on a tour, not of the Arch or Forest Park or the Mississippi River, but of what he calls the other St. Louis. Welcome, please, Bob Hansman and our own Steve Paulson.
Well, take me back to your own story. So you had been this up-and-coming artist, selling your work for a lot of money.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, that wasn't working for you.
No. It was around that time I started working with the kids in the projects at Peabody. And at that point, it just completely changed my idea about what art might be for. If I could use art to help these kids in the projects sort of feel different about themselves, that was good. But I just couldn't do it for myself anymore. It was, you know, I just couldn't justify doing drawings for people to hang on their walls when my kids downtown were dying.
So this was a rough neighborhood.
It was very rough. One of the kids was murdered the first week I was down there. It was mostly Bloods and Crips, mostly Bloods, more Bloods than Crips. And, you know, I was also teaching at Wash U at the time. And I think that, at first, it was just cognitive dissonance, because I told people many times, you know, I've got a binder in my office of the funeral notices of my children from downtown, and I don't have anything like that for my Wash U students. And right then, if you're a thinking person, you're going to start asking, why do my two groups of young people have such different pasts and presents and probably futures?
I have to put this in perspective. So during the day, your paid job is you're a professor of architecture at Washington University, one of the most elite colleges in the country. And then at night, you're going in, and you had moved into this area, right?
Yeah, it was interesting because some of the most important things in my life I didn't decide to do. People decided that I should do them. And so I was actually invited to move into the projects by the moms in 96.
Did you feel weird, though? I mean, being this white guy moving into this black neighborhood?
No. I'm trying to say yes, but no. Because by then, I had discovered so much love down there. There was much more love than I was experiencing where I was living. And it just seemed like, well, this is the most logical, inevitable place to be.
you got very close to some of the kids that you were teaching. One of your kids ended up moving in with you. Tell us that story.
Sure did. It was funny because I did think it was going to crash and burn when I first went down there, right? Because I thought there were these obvious differences. But the kids convinced me those differences weren't as important as other people thought they were. And the third summer, a boy I was very, very close to, Jermaine, died of sickle cell. And one of the boys who was just lost without Jermaine, because we were both lost in our own way, asked if he could move in with me at my other place. And so at that point, we, you know, Javon moved in with me, and it just evolved like that for a while. Javon stayed a couple days. After a couple more days, I said, it looks like you're going to be here a while. Do you want your own room?
And how old was Javon at the time?
About 14, something like that.
Javon, who is in the audience here.
He's over there. And after a few years, he just walked in the room one time and said, have you ever thought of adopting me? And I said, yes, I have, but I never brought it up because I didn't know how you felt. Well, that was it. Right? So he's my son now. I couldn't have asked for better.
He is now running the arts program that you started all those years ago.
He's now 36 years old. amazed he's still alive. Because a lot of his friends are not. The mortality rate is something that most people in this audience have never even considered. You know, Javon went to a funeral with me some years ago, one of my teachers who had died of old age, and it was, he said, it was almost beautiful because he'd never seen a funeral where somebody died of old age. So, yeah.
So you, something that you do in your job at Washington University as a professor there is you take a number of your students to certain neighborhoods of North St. Louis.
Yeah.
What are you trying to show these students? What are you hoping they understand?
Well, you know, a lot of things, but I think to some extent is to demystify and to actually unteach some of the things they've been taught. It's not a joke, really, but you know, the kids are about they take Bob's class and you go take us to all the places our parents told us never to go, right? And we fall in love. You know, and I tell my students, you know, don't ever be afraid to fall in love, especially in unexpected places, right? I mean, we've created these barriers, right? We simultaneously lament and respect these barriers. So this is funny because they'll go and they'll feel uncomfortable initially, right? What they don't realize is this is where I live. You know, this is where I worship. And so they'll be in the middle of some place that they're just totally frightened by, and suddenly the door will open and, you know, Reverend Davis will come out and go, Brother Bob, is this your latest group of kids? Anybody need to use the bathroom? Come on in, right? And suddenly it's like quits becoming this issue and it becomes people. People.
Yeah. So you talked earlier about love, about bringing more love into your own life. And maybe this sounds corny, but I'm wondering if there's, I mean, you know, dealing with these structural problems you've been talking about, dealing with inequality, with racial injustice. Is there a way to bring love into this discussion that
it's
would actually...
It's the only thing that's going to help.
Well, tell me how.
Yeah. You know, I look at this sort of structural inequity that we've all kind of become used to. I mean, like, you know, like, we've kept my grandson in the city schools, right? But he has to bring in his own toilet paper to help stock the schools. So when, you know, so when we look at this structural injustice, I think we have two reactions I can think of. One is to challenge that structure, and the other is to make it work for us. I'm not going to put my kid in that school. I'm not going to buy property in that neighborhood. And that simply exacerbates the larger problem for everyone else that can't make those choices. So I think about all the little things I do every day, you know, not big events. I always think about what are the habits, not the events, because it's our daily habits that kind of tell us where our values really are. I no longer can divide my life into what I think is good and bad, but what has meaning and what doesn't have meaning. And some of the most difficult parts of my life were the parts that dragged me kicking and screaming into meaning and what it really means to be alive. So the lesson, it's funny, my students at the end of the course, they kind of go, I think the whole point of this course was to make a friend. I go, yeah, the last day of my course is devoted to love. And we say it in academia, we say the word love. And I think if we could learn that and then act on it, not just talk about love as a noun, but, what's the verb? and how do you manifest that in your daily life? I think that's the key in getting back to falling in love in unexpected places. Right?
Yeah.
If I hadn't crossed those borders, I wouldn't have a son, and Javon would not have a father.
Well, in our own experience, just sharing a few hours with you, traveling around the city, and then having this conversation, it's an honor and it's a privilege to talk with you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bob Hansman is a professor of architecture at Washington University. He's the founder of the City Faces Arts Program and also the subject of a new documentary film called Bob's Tour, directed by June Bay. And he was talking with Steve Paulson. So we've been talking a lot about gates, gateways, borders, boundaries. And I hope this hour maybe inspired you to think about where in your life some of the boundaries and gateways are, and what you might discover, what love might be waiting for you if you crossed some of them. It's been so much fun being here with you tonight. I want to thank you for being a great audience. I want to thank St. Louis Public Radio for hosting us. Thanks to our producers, Steve Paulson, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers. The secret of radio is that behind every good producer is a much, much better audio engineer. I feel lucky every day to work with one of the best in the business, Joe Hartke. I want to give a shout out to our digital producer, Mark Rickers, who created all the videos we saw tonight. Thanks to Sign Up So Pro for amazing, amazing music. It's been our privilege to be here with you tonight. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.